welcome to Beyond the Cheers. I'm your host, Dave Ferguson. Thanks for joining our conversations inside and outside the world of sports and athletics on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the world of Beyond the Cheers. Tonight, we are going to jump in with both skates to the alarming and troubling statistics recently divulged that have slapped the puck right out of the rink. I'm talking about the recent study just released on concussions in hockey, where the numbers are just so astounding by the number of players that get their marbles juggled in the majority of cases. And yes, I'm going to say it, from irresponsible acts of downright stupidity in our national winter sport, whether from fighting, hits to the noggin, or an abrupt action causing the brain to be jarred from its lodgings. In the interview just prior to this show, Dr. Paul Eklund shared his findings, thoughts, musings, and advice on this very topic. Following up the conversation with Dr. Eklund, we will chat with Dr. Michael Cernota, the official neuropsychology consultant to the Canadian Hockey League, and with one of the Fifth Estate's finest investigative reporters, Bob McEwen, will join us as well. Bob, incidentally, won the Grey Cup in 1973 as a member of the Ottawa Rough Riders. I will invite you, the Beyond the Cheers family, later on in the broadcast to join in the conversation by a variety of means by calling 1-877-357-2448 or by email from the beyondthecheers.com website. You can also chat online through blogtalkradio.com/beyondthecheers. Without further ado, the interview with Dr. Paul Eklund. I'd like to welcome all the Beyond the Cheers faithful listeners to our show today about concussions in hockey. On November the 1st, results of a study on hockey concussions were revealed at a press conference in Toronto. The alarming results indicated that 17 players suffered 21 concussion incidents in 52 games of junior hockey during a study of two teams. 25% of junior hockey players on the two unnamed teams suffered concussions. This report comes after independent physicians followed two junior clubs during the 2009-2010 season. A panel of doctors released these eye-opening findings during the news conference. Dr. Paul Eklund of London, Ontario, said 29% of players who had a concussion also endured recurring concussions. Today we have as our guest Dr. Paul Eklund, who led the Hockey Concussion Education Project. Dr. Eklund is a fellowship-trained and certified primary care sports medicine specialist, currently practicing family and sports medicine in London, Ontario. He has provided junior hockey medical coverage for the past 10 years at all levels. That's OHL, Junior A, NCAA, Division 1, Junior B, and Junior D. So this gentleman knows, this doctor knows what he's talking about. He's got the experience behind him, and this was all in U.S. and Canada. He has 7 first author publications with an interest in sports concussion and sport-related injuries, past chair of the London Hockey Concussion Summit, and past co-chair of the HNCI, which is the Hockey Neurotrauma and Concussion Initiative, stakeholders meeting January 2009, current research chair of the Hockey Neurotrauma Concussion Initiative, National Research Committee, and chair of the HCNI Concussion Diagnosis and Registry Standardization Subcommittee, current primary investigator of the Hockey Concussion Education Project. Welcome, Dr. Eklund.
Well, thank you for that nice introduction. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. I just wanted to start off, maybe you can just enlighten our listeners that weren't available yesterday for the press conference, or for some reason or other didn't read it in the press at all. Just a sort of a snapshot, a brief one, albeit, with the results that were furnished yesterday.
Well, again, this is a study that was done in the 2009-2010 season using two junior-aged hockey teams. And what we did was look at independent physician observing and diagnosing concussions at the rink, and then follow these the injured players through their recovery, hopefully, and some lengthy recoveries. But this is the first time that you've had independent observers and an independent observer physician. So there's usually about 3 observers at the rink. They're elevated along the blue line, so I had good vision of the ice, much better than before. As a team physician, you normally stand in the corner or at ice level. So we looked at the injuries, probable concussion injuries, when one did occur, a probable one. We identified it, radioed down to the bench, and got that player taken off the ice, evaluated them in a spare change room, and made the decision whether there was concussion or not. In 34 cases we identified, there was 18 that were diagnosed as a concussion and taken out of the game and sent to my clinic the next day, and 16 that were returned to play. So it was about 50-50. It wasn't we were taking out every player that had an injury or that had a hit to the head. These were diagnosed in a very serious manner with criteria that we wanted to look at how the player reacted after the hit, you know, whether there was significant symptoms to evaluate. And that resulted in, again, these statistics, which are conservative, and that's the underlying conservative, because we looked at just the teams that we were following, not the teams that they were playing. So that kind of doubles the amount of players in the total study. Again, 21 concussions, 52 games, 25% of all players, and that's 67 players that participated, and 17 of that 67 played only 5 games or less. So those are big statistics. 29% got recurrent concussions, which are the most dangerous.
And you said also those are conservative numbers as well, so we got to keep that in mind as well.
Yeah.
Now, at the press conference yesterday as well, it mentioned the numbers were 7 times greater than expected. Can you just elaborate just a tad on that?
Well, no, it the 7 times is 7 times greater than it's ever reported in the literature for this age group, and that was a Division I study done in 2005. And it didn't have the direct observation, didn't have the sensitivity that we have. So, I mean, if that's the highest that's reported, then we have to look at it seriously to see what are we actually reporting. And I think the difference may be in that in the last 10 years there's been a significant improvement in standardization of a definition of concussion and the way we look at it objectively. So, you know, as we evolve with the knowledge, so we'll get probably the concussions that have always been there. And there may be a bit more because of the development of skills.
Correct. Okay. Just a little historical snapshot. Are we better now, as say, 10, 20 years ago, at recognizing concussions?
I think it's coming. Like I said, I think it's progressing, and it takes people to push that and make that progress happen. I think that the reason I got involved specifically with concussion as a subspecialty now is that I get tired of seeing these young men and women, and women too, mm-hmm. because they also get concussion, have these injuries and be taken out of school, being unable to socialize with friends, really disrupting their quality of life. And this happens at all age groups, whether you're a 34-year-old pro or a 9-year-old peewee, and it really is disturbing. And it was even more disturbing when there was nothing really being done, and this is happening again and again. You know, a bell ringer, but that word should be struck from the vocabulary because a concussion is a concussion, and there is no mild or gradient concussions. It is a serious brain injury, and it affects individuals differently.
With regards to concussions, maybe just for the coaches or the trainers or somebody in the bench that are actually listening to the show, is there different ways to receive a concussion? Is it a check to the head? Is it a snapping back action? Or is it a myriad of different ways that they can receive a concussion in hockey?
Well, you see, to understand concussion, it's the movement, the rapid movement of the brain, which is sitting in cerebral spinal fluid or fluid inside the skull. So it's rotating and it's going back and forth at the same time when it's hit suddenly. And you can hit the body and cause a concussion, and you can hit the head directly and have a concussion. You can have a whiplash or a glancing blow and have a concussion. Like you said, a myriad of ways of that occurring. And the patient or player will have a feeling of dizziness, a balance disturbance, loss of consciousness. Obviously, if there's loss of consciousness, there's a concussion. Loss of memory, concentration, feeling not right, feeling like they're going to throw up or nauseated. All of those things. There's about 20 different ones that you can think of. Any one can be an indicator of concussion. A player should be taken out off the ice and sent to be evaluated by a physician that's familiar with concussion.
Okay. The definition that a lot of the individuals get in our neck of the woods that comes out in a training manual has got the definition as a concussion is a brain injury. A concussion may involve loss of consciousness. However, a concussion most often occurs without a loss of consciousness. Is that a good definition, or does it need some more to be elaborated on that?
That's exactly right. I mean, it used to be 20 years ago you had to lose consciousness to be considered a concussion. We know better now because we know that the concussion is a disruption of your cognition or your thought. It can affect all the sensorium, like the vision and hearing and senses. It's really disrupting the metabolic activity of the brain, which is so sensitive. It can do some physical disruption in the vessels and the nerves too. But I think that's an important point to get across: is that it doesn't have to have a loss of consciousness.
Gotcha.
And then the important part is when this happens is to remove the player and get him properly assessed.
Okay. Now, a quarter of the results of concussion incidents, from what I understand, were from fighting, were they not?
Yeah, that was 24%. Five of the 17 players sustained a concussion immediately after a fight, being involved in a fight.
So your report actually feeds twofold. Basically, the head checks and things are blindside hits to the head or sudden jerks of motion that, cause the head movement, as well as fighting and hockey.
Yeah, I mean, the last two main groups of experts that I attended, the London group and then which I chaired, and the Mayo group, which was a couple of weeks ago, came to the same conclusions. I mean, if you really want to decrease the incidence rate of concussion, then you get rid of all hits to the head, and whether they be incidental or purposeful. And that includes fighting. I mean, fighting was spoken to by Hockey Canada executives saying that fighting should be out of the game. When that happens, I think people should listen, because when you have all the experts, including the hockey experts, saying that this should be, then, if we can get rid of the intentional ones, there's always, when you play a contact sport, concussions will occur. And that's why the education to identify them and get them treated appropriately. But if we can get rid of the ones that are intentional or the ones that affect hits to the head, then I think we're going to be on the road to improving the sport.
Exactly. The rates of concussion, now you looked at a group of young men, I guess somewhere around the age of 18. Does rate of concussion incident rise as the player's age goes up and their skill level increases?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, this is an excellent question. We don't know because, like I said, this is the first study to really do the gold standard, do independent observation and diagnosis. I mean, logically, looking at it, if you gain 40 pounds and increase a step or step and a half and increase, the will to win, would your rate go down? I mean, that's a good question to ask.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the stop sign program that a lot of minor hockey associations have in play, is that just your opinion? Has it dropped some of the hits from behind, perhaps? Maybe players a little more conscious of those hits?
That was a great effort to get that stop sign placed, and still is. It has. It's decreased. I mean, if you talk to Dr. Charles Tatter, he'll tell you absolutely it has. I mean, this is the kind of initiatives that need to be done. Unfortunately, with concussion, it's not always from the back. It's from the front, side, body. And I don't know if there's an answer like that for concussion. I think it's a cultural issue to really understand that the brain is our precious resource and that we should protect it. And we still want to play competitive contact sport, but we have to step back and say, is what we're doing right now really worth it?
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. There also may be the perception, too, with the better equipment, the lighter equipment, there's more padding of the helmets, and they're not being marketed as concussion-proof, but do you think there might be a bit of a perception from young players thinking, oh, I've got this brand-new fancy $200, $300, $500 helmet out there. It's going to prevent me from concussion.
I mean, that's another good question. The equipment makers and the equipment itself has improved substantially, as you can tell if you go back into the 60s versus what we're wearing now. Mm-hmm. That's always an area that we can reassess. Is this a potential avenue that we can improve to decrease injury? there is no concussion-proof helmet. There's no concussion-proof mouth guard. Mouth guards are great to protect against jaw fractures and tooth fractures, but there really isn't, and that point has to be driven through. I mean, it really, again, I keep coming back to it, but it's the social aspect of playing this great sport we have, and you know, maintaining your physical fitness, enjoying the competition, and improving your skills, playing with everything you got, but really looking not to destroy, or you're not at war. And this has to be driven through by the adults who are supervising, mm-hmm. including the referees, coaches, executives. This is not a war. This is a sport. It's a game.
Exactly. I read an article a couple of years ago that basically said if they were going to make a concussion-proof helmet, if it was feasible, the player wouldn't be able to wear it because it would be too heavy.
And then, you know, that was discussed at the Mayo Clinic meetings. And it's not the great kazoo. I mean, it's you cannot create something better than what you have as a skull.
Exactly.
And, you know, the CSA protection was designed to prevent skull fractures and brain bleeds. It's done a great job. There's very few of them that occur. And there are occasionally one, but, you know, that's what it is designed to protect. And the ones we have right now, yeah, they do the job, but they do not prevent concussion because you've already got one.
Exactly. Does one concussion make a player or an athlete more susceptible to a secondary and third?
What we know is that the you know, if a player has a concussion, he's treated appropriately. Usually recovers completely. If the player is not treated appropriately and is put back into play, or he puts himself back into play, which is often the case, he has not recovered. He is more susceptible because his brain's still not recovered. And that's when it becomes dangerous. The ultimate danger is called second impact syndrome, where you have pressure developing on a second hit after he's still recovering, and you can have death. And it does occur yearly. Especially with high school football in the States and occasionally in hockey. But it's a rare but probably underreported instance of death. But the more what you were talking about is the recurrence of concussion. When you have one or you have multiple, there is, you know, that's empirically from my experience, especially after about three and as happened in this study. Mm-hmm. They were out for much, the guys that had the multiple concussion history were out for a longer period of time with their symptoms lingered for a lot longer than the other ones that had one or two. So that's, again, from this study, it shows what we know already and it documents it.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in to Beyond the Cheers. We'll be right back with Dr. Paul Eklin. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cheers on Blog Talk Radio. Please join the conversation by dialing in toll-free 1-877-357-2448 or visit us to blog, comment, and ask questions at beyondthecheers.com. Please stay in touch and follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or at beyondthecheers.com. Welcome back to Beyond the Cheers. We're talking to Dr. Paul Eklin on a study that he was the lead physician on concussions in hockey. You know, one thing that came out, common denominator out of the conference yesterday was education. Now, education of the player, for the player, education of the coach, education for the parent. And that's a astounding thing that we need to capitalize on and get that out there. Just going back into the training manual that some of the individuals get this in our province in Ontario, there's only 2 to 4 pages on concussions. And I don't, personally, my own opinion, they don't spend an awful lot of time on it. And it's very difficult for a volunteer individual that has taken a weekend class to identify a concussion as opposed to a medically trained individual.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reason that we had doctors doing the observation and that was more of a gold standard, we don't expect that. We expect the improvement of the education part and for the leagues and for the teams to take it seriously. That's when the cultural shift occurs and when they actually identify it as something they have to proceed on and they want to spend time on. And that's where we have to work at. You know, I think ultimately you want the therapist to be skilled enough, the guy that's on the bench, whether it be a volunteer at the lower levels, to be skilled enough and have certified enough to and to have immediate contact with an allied physician that is skilled. And so he can discuss a player that he's not quite sure about, because that will happen a lot of times. Like you said, it's a difficult and highly trained skill. So you want that kind of connection to be there so the kid is the child that's playing is protected. And in a lot of cases, it's not a priority, and I think it should become one.
Which pathway do you think this may take? Is it going to go through the hockey organizations to start getting more education of the player, coach, parent? Or maybe it might be twofold, two avenues to explore, is be that one, and perhaps some sort of government intervention, whether it's at the provincial or federal level.
Well, we'd hope that it would come from the grassroots, right? We'd hope that the informed hockey associations and the coaches, that their number one thing, you know, most of the people out at rinks and the majority are exceptionally good people and giving their time and their skills. So we hope that it comes from there. Obviously, it didn't come enough in the states, so they started to legislate it. And it may be a combination of both.
Now, with the release of that study, what's the next step? Are there further studies, different age groups that might be in the offing?
Yeah, well, this year, currently, we're doing a pilot in the university, in the CIS, in men's hockey. Again, we can't disclose which team, but to see how that works. We're not using the observer component of it because we want to make sure that it works within the system first. That's going forward this year. Through some of the international committees I'm working with, we're looking at replicating what we did this year or this past year in multiple sites, multiple sports, and multiple gender, or, you know, the two genders, the male and female, so that we really do see and reproduce what we saw here, as well as getting, you know, every time you intervene, you educate. So those are good things. And to see, say, Australian rugby versus Canadian hockey at different age groups, what is this? You know, what are the real statistics? I mean, is the incidence rate that high? Is it different? Why is it different? And, you know, we did this pretty rapidly, this study, in about 14 months. Mm-hmm. And I think this can be reproduced again with international cooperation. And people who do not want to do it, that's fine. But I think there's enough people at this time that really do want to find the answer. And also, along the way, intervene and educate.
With all the education that we may be putting out or any new rules and training, how do we get past the athletes out there that don't want to report it? Or how do we get past the mentality of the suck it up and go back out and play? Or will we ever get past that?
Well, I mean, those are some of the cultural barriers that we're dealing with. And I think it, you know, enforcement is a big incentive. You know, you get a positive or negative enforcement. You take something away from people that like their ice time if they you know, go against a league rule, or you take the, you know, coach's ability if he goes against the league rule concerning this. It has to, you know, you really have to have the support of all the groups involved, and there will be, as this evolves, people that don't want to comply, and so that's where enforcement has to come in to say this is what we believe to be best for our children.
Exactly.
And whether, again, the children are 34-year-olds or they're 9-year-olds. And
exactly.
Everybody's responsible for this.
There's always a fly in the ointment, no matter what programs are put in place.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yesterday you had Dr. Michael Cosimano, I guess, and from St. Michael's.
Yep.
As well. He had rattled off some numbers as well. He said 15 to 20,000 concussions that season. Is that... I didn't want to take him out of context, but what market would that be? Is that Canada-wide or North America-wide? Or
probably Canada-wide. You know, in the States, which has a bit, you know, again, we really want to define what concussion is, and the numbers, you know, are something, you know, it should never be mistaken, because numbers are people and they're human beings with
Absolutely.
Brain injuries. But in the States, the Center for Disease Control looks at a 300,000 to a million. And then the one of the brain injury groups looks at 3 million per year, and that's recreational and sport, what was defined or is defined as concussion. And so those are astounding numbers. If
wow.
it was any other health issue, everybody else would be all over this.
Yeah.
You know, it would be telethons for it. But And I'm just putting it lightly, I shouldn't be, but those are numbers that should not be dismissed. The numbers in this study should not be dismissed. Again, these are young individuals that suffer silently most of the time.
Where is the leadership for this, the initiative taking ownership of concussions and dealing with it in the education? Where does that you see that coming from? Like I know we'd mentioned it earlier about hockey organizations, the parents and such like that. Is there, should we be doing more to get this ball rolling a lot quicker?
Well, that's a good question. It's actually the if you look at the Toronto Star today, it's Randy Starkman's headline or ball. You know, where's the leadership? And I think that came out of the press conference yesterday. And you know, I truly believe it's the change, the cultural change, which will be the ultimate change in this, in concussion decreasing or increasing prevention and decreasing incidents, will come from the grassroots, and people will finally realize, hopefully through education, that brain injury is not something that they think is part of their recreation or competitive sport. And that although there's a possibility of it happening, it's not something that should be happening on this magnitude.
Exactly.
And everybody, like I said, everybody's responsible. And then if we can get majority of people wanting change, then it will happen.
Thank you, Dr. Eklund. That was a interview we had just a few days after the press conference. As I said at the top of the show, we are joined by Dr. Michael Cernota, the official neuropsychology consultant to Canadian Hockey League and many, many more sports organizations spread throughout Canada and the United States. We are also privileged to be joined by former Ottawa Rough Rider, 1973 Grey Cup champ, if memory serves correctly, and CBC's Fifth Estate investigative reporter, Bob McEwen. Welcome to both of you folks for joining us on Beyond the Cheers.
Hi, Dave. Thank you very much.
Okay. Dr. Cernota, quickly right off the top, you were part of the army of physicians that were involved in that study. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Was there any resentment or were the players or the teams, coaches, were they threatened with the thought process or the thought that you folks were coming in and looking at concussions?
There was. One of the teams had a little more experience with us from a clinical background in previous years, and one of the teams did decide it was a voluntary participation arrangement, that it needs to be voluntary, and one of the teams felt that it was a little too intrusive and actually dropped out of the study halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I've gone and talked with high school coaches and am still presented with the resistance where the coaches are misbelieving that I'm there to demonstrate that the sports cause brain injury or brain damage. And I tell them I'm really there to bring the point home that you know that these injuries happen and we have a responsibility to take care of them the best way we can.
Absolutely. Bob, from your side of the fence, you spent a few seasons in the, I believe, the bell ringer mentality back in the 70s. From your exposure in back in the 70s to date, has there been improvement in education and recognition and concussions with regards to athletes of all ages?
Well, I think unquestionably. However, it's only taken, I don't know if Michael would agree with this or not, but it's only taken place in really recent years. You know, if you look at the National Football League, a couple of years ago, their concussion committee, or their head injury committee, whatever it was called, was still sort of adamantly insisting that there was really no correlation between long-term head injury and the collisions that took place on a football field. You know, so I fully admit my generation was a long time ago. And for us, head injuries, concussions simply weren't credible injuries. You didn't report them. The trainers and doctors didn't ask about them. And, you know, I have several former teammates who are suffering from severe dementia right now. And there are studies going on in the National Football League of people of my generation, which are, quite dismaying for somebody of my age. So, yes, there's no question there's been a sea change, but it's been very recent. And I guess the problem is whether the culture that that Paul Eklund was talking about is kept up.
Okay.
I agree completely with what Bob's saying, is that there's so much has gone on just within the past probably 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just been a remarkable change, and I don't, when you look back, and I try to be as objective and fairly humble to some degree, because history will judge us as to how well we're doing, and I'm not going to disparage athletes that played in previous decades, because they played the way the framework was for them at that time.
Exactly.
Just the way that everybody smoked cigarettes at that time, and hopefully as we gather more information and we learn some more things, we'll do things wiser or better and learn from what we can do.
Okay. I'd like to just take a brief pause here for the moment. I just want to invite our Beyond the Cheers listeners to feel free to give a call to 1-877-357-2448, or you're more than welcome to go on to beyondthecheers.com. Send an email in, and there's also a chat line session that is open through Blog Talk Radio. Feel free to send your questions in to Dr. Michael Cernota or to Bob McEwen or to myself with regards to concussions in hockey, or even your side of the fence where you came from with your own personal experience and relate that to us. We'd be more than welcome to take some of those informative and some questions to the guests we have assembled here this evening. Wanted to throw out there too, Dr. Cernota, with regards to all the associations and organizations that you're a consultant with. Is there still as we mentioned in the interview with Dr. Eklund, is there still that suck it up attitude really prevalent still today with players, especially in hockey?
It is. It's pretty hard to change. I think that we've made some grounds, but I'm just as susceptible as that as anybody. I broke a bone in my foot playing hockey a few years ago and didn't go get it x-rayed for 2 weeks and was ready to play on it again and all that kind of thing. And that's a very different thing than having a brain injury. But I'm hoping that the work that I do with the junior teams, that as they progress up the ladder and start playing minor pro or NHL hockey, that it's going to become just part of the game, that they acknowledge it, they deal with it, and they move forward in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be some kind of black box, bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
That they need to avoid at all costs.
Okay. It came out a couple of weeks ago as well at the same conference that Dr. Eklund chaired with regards to the NFL, and we spoke briefly on the NFL just moments ago, that there's, I believe the number is 9 states right now have legislation in place for headshots in NFL, and that's trickling down to the younger groups of kids that play football in the United States, simply because they want to protect the players coming through the system that potentially could be playing in the National Football League. Is that something we need to perhaps take a look at here in Canada, is legislation, or are the organizations savvy enough to take this on and run with it?
Well, that's a very good question. Bob, do you have a sense as to with the work that you do?
Well,
people are responding.
We came across this. Obviously, my own personal interest is that I had a number of concussions back in my playing days, which were never treated. Mm-hmm. And I know from reading the various scientific literature that's not necessarily a good thing. But we started out doing a piece about Chris Benoit, the world wrestling mm-hmm. star who's from Edmonton, who tragically a few years ago it killed his wife and son and himself. And when we were doing a story about this, and at the time the prevalent opinion was this was steroid-related in some way. So we wanted to talk to his father, Mike, who lives in Edmonton. And essentially when we were there, Mike got a call from a guy named Chris Nowinski. Chris Nowinski is a former Harvard football player who became a world WWE wrestler, but who's now part of something called the Sports Legacy Institute in Boston, because Chris suffered severe concussions. And basically what he was asking was that Mike allow them to include Chris's brain in a study done by Dr. Julian Bales at the University of West Virginia, or West Virginia University, of former National Football League players who had more than one undiagnosed or untreated concussions, and who in their 50s, at the end of their careers, had suffered some unusual kind of death. And this included a number of people, foremost among them Mike Webster, the All-Pro Hall of Fame center, who had won four Super Bowl rings. And when they looked at Mike Webster's brain posthumously, they found that Dr. Bales says that it looked as if it were the brain of an 85 or 90-year-old Alzheimer's patient. And when they looked at Chris Benoit's brain, which his dad allowed them to do, it was even worse than that. And that is a very disturbing thing for people of my generation. Now, the more disturbing thing that's happened recently is that in the springtime, a football player at the University of Pennsylvania who's 21 and who had never had a diagnosed concussion killed himself. And when they analyzed his brain tissue, they found the same pattern. And, Michael, you'll correct me. I think it's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE.
Right.
They found the same pattern in his brain. So here's somebody who's not 52, he's 21, and who hasn't had a series of concussions as Mike Webster of the Pittsburgh Steelers had. He's had none diagnosed, yet he has the same pattern. Now, you know, this obviously, I'm obviously not a research scientist, but for somebody of my generation looking at people playing football today, this is very disturbing that could be the case of somebody of that age.
The laws in the state have come about as a way of trying to keep the high school athletes from being put back to play and facing undue pressures to play while hurt, and having that risk of what, you know, Bob is talking about are these additive effects that happen in certain athletes for certain reasons that we don't understand fully. The legislation in the states has been aimed at addressing the more immediate acute issues that can happen if you play repeatedly while hurt, and that's what Dr. Eklund was talking about, the second impact syndrome, where you do have abrupt brain swelling and a very high mortality rate. And so they want to try to help the coaches recognize the injuries when they happen, understand that their job is not to put pressure on a young player to go back and play while they're symptomatic. Not going to help the team, doesn't help the kid in school, and it increases his risk for a very lethal outcome.
Absolutely.
And the culture clearly is still an issue here. I mean, even this season, when the National Football League has cracked down in essentially the same way the National Hockey League did last year by having a system where there's additional discipline. So even if somebody has not been penalized during a game for a hit to the head, upon further review a day or two later, they can be fined for doing so, which has happened a number of times in the National Football League and pursuant to the rules that came into the NHL last year in hockey as well. But there have still been a couple of cases in both sports. You know, one, a linebacker whose team I forget at the moment, and the other, Colton Orr, the fighter for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Orr was knocked out in a fight and played again the next night or two nights later. The linebacker in the NFL, everyone saw him staggering off the field, yet a series or two later he was back on the field. So I don't know whether this is inattentive training personnel or just a cultural issue, but clearly there are still issues culturally in both of these sports, football and hockey, that require some attention.
And a lot of that can come right from the player themselves. If there's, depending on...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Depending on what league they're in, there could be a scout in the stands. Well, I got to get out, back out there. If they don't see me, I haven't got a shot.
If you're Colton Orr and your job is to fight,
yep,
and you get knocked out in a fight, well, what could be worse than not going back out there the next day? Nothing. You know, that's your, it's your job.
Exactly.
That's also your health or your life, arguably. But, I mean, given the culture of the NHL these days, who could blame them?
Why the difference in the penalization of the player versus fines versus minutes is something that the NHL still has to wrestle with despite their rulings on blind hits to the head and concussion possibilities and stuff like that? Or do they have to actually wait till see what happens with the player before they penalize them?
I suspect that anytime you try to link the severity of the injury to the penalty, you run into all kinds of problems, because if somebody has great intent to really harm someone and is unsuccessful, then they're penalized less, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the player wasn't hurt as bad as he could have been hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the intent was there, and that's what's hard, is to try to legislate intent or to have referees. Referees have a pretty good idea. They're bright guys. They're experienced people. They understand. They've got good judgment. I think have some discretion about whether there wasn't. I know the OHL, I looked up the rule in case you needed to know that,
mm-hmm,
where the referee does have the discretion to either call a minor penalty if there was a hit to the head, or a major penalty with a game misconduct if they believe that there was really intent to injure. They've got some discretion in that right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to wait to find out how badly the player was hurt.
Are the penalties being issued this season, are they strong enough in order to make an actual difference?
I don't know. I've talked to the league. The league now, it's amazing how much does trickle down and how very professional the Canadian Hockey League is,
mm-hmm,
in terms of the staffing and the. I think almost every game is digitally recorded now, right? And everything is made, copied immediately and given to the opponent so that they can look at tape the next day and all that kind of thing. So I have talked to the league about trying to maybe come up with a bit of a research project for us to go back and look through some of those game tapes,
mm-hmm,
and find out how well the players are changing their behavior. There was talk in the NFL that some of the players have changed their behavior and they haven't been hitting as ferociously because they don't want to get fined. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find out if it really changes
the
behavior long term.
Exactly. I can't help think back to when Wayne Primeau played in the NHL and had a short career and ultimately had to call it quits in the 2005-2006 time frame. He suffered for a long time with concussions and still does to this day from playing in the NHL for the small number of seasons that he played. I think it was 909 regular season games that he actually played, and still suffers to this day from the results of concussion. I wanted to take a look, though, if we could, with the education factor, stepping aside from the NHL and the OHL, down to a bit of the junior, the minor leagues, the midgets, the bantams, the peewees, for concussions. Is the education enough for these individuals that are volunteer and out of the goodness of their heart standing behind the bench? Can they recognize concussions properly?
I can't speak to that specifically, though. I've helped to coach my son's football team in Quebec, his high school football team in Quebec recently, and I'm incredibly aware of this,
mm-hmm,
for perhaps obvious reasons. But also, he's been playing minor hockey in a rural area of Quebec north of Ottawa. And here, I mean, he's been a peewee and a bantam, and there's no hitting. And I have never seen in four seasons of driving hundreds of thousands of kilometers through Quebec during the winter to watch hockey games, I've never seen a head injury. I haven't seen anybody get hit in the head because there's not body contact, and not body checking anyway, allowed. So, you know, I grew up playing hockey and football and relishing in a great collision, and I have had numerous concussions. My son has had none,
mm-hmm,
playing hockey because, I would say, because of the rules. So, you know, I understand the Don Cherry and Nick Kyprios point of view, but and it's a totally non-scientific poll. But over the past 4 years, watching minor hockey, hundreds of games, I haven't seen a single, or what I believed was a single, or recognized as a single head injury in Quebec because of the rules.
Yeah, that's being investigated. And there was a big study recently that did look at, I think, Ontario and Alberta, peewee first-year players and similar age players in Quebec to look at the effects of body checking. And there was a much higher injury rate and concussion rate in the body checking leagues than there was in the Quebec league. There's supposed to be a follow-up study that looks at the first-year Bantam players to find out if that injury difference is due to the body checking or due to the age at which it's introduced. I know that that's all being questioned. I mean, I think the good part is that there are lots of people looking at many ways that we can try to reduce this injury. And it's a very complicated situation, so it's not going to be something that can easily be changed. I know you had touched on it before with helmet design or with a change in penalties or something like that. It's going to take, I think, many different interventions to try to reduce this as much as possible and reduce the negative consequences when these injuries happen. When it comes to the coaching, I think it's a real hard situation. I know I'm involved with the OHF and trying to improve education for their coaches and the trainers that they have, putting current materials, giving them access to online training courses, trying to drive home access to information, in touch with the right kind of clinicians in the community so that the players get the care that they need and that the parents and the coaches get good feedback from the doctors rather than having doctors perhaps relying on outdated information and say, oh, well, this was a grade one concussion, so you're out for 1 week, or this was a grade two concussion, so you're out for 2 weeks, and just really trying to raise the bar across the board. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and there's a lot of people involved. This is moving. There's a lot of inertia to overcome.
Exactly. We're just in
Michael, when we talk about it being generational in terms of athletes, and it clearly, you know, my generation is one thing, but do you see that in terms of the medical and training regimens as well? Is it something that is simply changing with the new generations?
It is. I mean, you know, there's been so much press and so many conferences that are put out over the last, I think, starting in 98, perhaps, so over the last dozen years, and there's just big changes. Again, it's no longer the unspoken to the same degree that it used to be. So, yeah, there is a generational thing. I think that the twist on it, though, is when you get down to, like, the peewee class and the Bantam class, you're still dealing with parents of a different generation, obviously. And you do get a little bit more of a, well, when I played hockey or when I played ball, we didn't do that, and this is how we played through those things, and that's what I expect my kid to do too.
So I
just kind of take the approach to say, just keep an open mind, because when your dad played football, he didn't wear a face mask. But you didn't unscrew the one that they gave to you, right? You wanted all the protection and all the technology and all the improvements that were available to you. That's what we want to give to your son and your daughter.
Yeah, I remember the day when I didn't have to wear a helmet playing hockey myself. So back when I first started. Where do we need to go with the information that we've got at hand? Is it education? Is it rule changes at the minor hockey league level, whether, you know, we eliminate fighting, we eliminate body contact, or is that all rolled into one big answer?
The National Hockey League says as dedicated to eliminating headshots as they would claim to be. Well, surely the most intentional, the most deliberate headshot is a punch to the face.
Correct.
Yep, there still seems to be a disconnect as far as the NHL is concerned in those two things.
I agree. My experience is that, again, it's not going to be a single solution or intervention that really reduces the rate of injury across the board, but we want to look at incremental change and everything that we can do to try to reduce that. Fighting has a direct association, like Bob says, with head trauma. I mean, obviously, in boxing, that's the whole point of the sport. But it's a fairly small component to the injuries that I see. And I think what the listeners might be surprised at is we already have a league that does not allow checking and that does not allow fighting, and they have a concussion rate that's every bit as high as the leagues that do. And that's women's collegiate sports, right? Women's collegiate hockey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, again, if we eliminate all the headshots and we eliminate all the fighting, I don't want people to be misunderstanding and think that you'll completely take concussions out of the game, because we won't.
So a lot of the leadership basically comes down to the sports organizations to get the game straightened out and back, so it's safe for kids to go in and play hockey and not have the expectation of, you know, having to use the old phrase of having their bell rung and something life-altering that they're not able to perform to the best of their abilities any longer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of education, and when I work with people and who have been injured and we work them back into health, I remind them that when they go back on the field or when they go back on the ice, that they are still assuming a certain level of risk.
Mm-hmm.
We just want their risk of injury to be as low as everyone else on the ice and not end up having kind of a lot of people understand when they have a knee injury that their knee is never quite as strong as it was before, so their risk of having a second knee injury may be slightly greater than if they hadn't had that first injury.
Yeah. One of our Beyond the Cheers...
There's always a chance that you can have an...
Sorry, Dr. Arsenato.
Right.
One of our Beyond the Cheers listeners had sent in the message, and this is from Jane. It says, it's a physical sport. What are you going to do? Removing contact completely is the only solution. And if that day happens, I hope I'm gone. So there's still that mentality, if you will, of individuals going out there to watch the fight at the hockey game or watch players get knocked around in a boarded in area. And I think.
Yeah, but I don't think it's looking for Matt Cook to hit Mark Savard in the head and put him out for a season or forever.
No.
You know, or James Harrison to put that head hit on that got him suspended for three games this year in the NFL, you know? I mean, the phrase that keeps coming back in hockey circles anyway is respect. And it just seems to me that people have to recognize the size and speed and therefore the physical dynamics of the sport have changed from the days of Rocket Richard and Frank Mihajlovic. And, you know, we think of those as the good old days. Well, you know what? To a degree, we have to try to reclaim that. They didn't hit each other with the same force and speed and impact then as they do now. And to hit one another in the head at these forces is just lunacy. So... You know, I think the notion of respect, whatever that means, remembering that these guys are out there playing on the same basis that you are and realizing that you don't have to kill them is not a bad thing.
Exactly. A couple of listeners.
I saw that that there was a review recently that looked at the size of the defensemen for one of the OHL teams and compared them against the size of the defensive core for the 84 Oilers, and the junior players were both taller and heavier. So, yes, the players are larger, the ice surface is the same. And one of the things that has come up before is that the players in Richard's day played more of the game. They took longer shifts and they played more minutes each night.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that the way the game has evolved now is that these players are able to skate in a sprint style, full bore, for 35 or 40 seconds, and then they get off the ice. They don't get tired where they can't get to that check and finish it with full force.
I spent a year and a half with the Edmonton Oilers back in the day, and I cannot remember in all of that time Dave Semenko or Marty McSorley or Kevin McClelland hitting anybody in the head, honestly. I mean, you know, Craig McTavish was still playing with a helmet in those days.
Right.
So, you know, there were body checks. They weren't hits to the head. And it was something, call it, whether it was respect or self-preservation or just the way it was done, but it wasn't done the way it's done today.
No.
And that can be one of the things that has come up in discussion is, you know, the issue of equipment, and it's hard to undo the equipment changes that have happened because there are definite positives associated with it. But there's even concern that as I approach a player who looks like he's fully protected, I don't distinguish between a vulnerable body part and a less vulnerable body part. Whereas when the player did not wear a helmet, it was pretty clear that I wasn't going to hit an unprotected piece of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there may be that the perception that I'm not going to hurt them because they're protected. There definitely is the change in behavior that when a player is better protected, they do tend to play more recklessly because they feel safer with all the gear they have on. And they call that the risk compensation. So the more you protect them, the more risky they play because they feel they can't possibly get hurt.
Very true. And I know I certainly wouldn't feel safe out there with 2,400 pounds skating around on the ice either, so let alone all the gear that the NHL players have on as well. We're running right near the end of the show, gentlemen. I've got about 3 minutes left on the cuckoo clock on the wall. Is there any other things that we need to bring up and chat for the sake of our listeners, for the young kids listening, for the parents, for the coaches? Any words of wisdom and advice, and I'll take Bob. You got anything else left to throw out to our audience?
Well, I get back to the issue of young people suffering these head injuries, which, you know, I don't recall being again. Now, this may be a head injury related as well, but I don't recall that being an issue in my time. It was an issue when I played in the Canadian Football League. Again, I don't remember anybody in high school or, you know, minor football having this issue. So, is it the way we played? Is it the equipment we play in? I don't know, but there's some difference today from, you know, a generation ago. And it just seems to me that the issue of awareness and respect are central to it. You know, we were actually taught back in my day to hit with our heads,
mm-hmm.
our own heads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that clearly that was not a good thing to do. And equally clearly, it's not a good thing to hit anyone else in the head. You know, you get the argument that Zdeno Chara has no choice because he's 6'9", and there are players in the league who are 5'10", and if he hits them, he's definitively going to hit them in the head.
Exactly.
Well, that's no excuse.
No.
There's no excuse for hitting somebody in the head, and I think that's sort of the bottom line in all of this. You wouldn't want to be hit in the head. We've seen the medical reasons why. You shouldn't be hitting somebody else.
Absolutely. Dr. Sarnoda, you
agree? Well, I think that there's so many young people that are playing the game, and so few that make it to the NFL or the CFL or the NHL, that I think it's imperative that right now when we're dealing with young players, their job is to learn and grow and become independent individuals. And so, you know, to try to tell a 9-year-old that he's got to suck it up and go play the game, while I agree that there's a certain amount that you want to do to be part of the team and to really have that perseverance, when it comes to a brain injury, when it comes to concussion and you run the risk of them doing poorly in school for the next couple of weeks because they're not feeling right, I don't think that's a good choice. And I think that the more we can educate the parents to say this is the best way we can do things right now, the better off we'll be.
Okay. Very good. I think we've had a good discussion here. Hopefully our listeners certainly enjoyed that. Just going to wrap things up here at the end of the show. And again, I'd like to thank Bob McEwen and Dr. Michael Cernota for being on Beyond the Cheers tonight, sharing the concussion story with our avid listeners out there. And hopefully someday soon we'll get this right, and so a lot of players don't have to go through life feeling that they have to sit in a dark room for 3 hours a day because they've had multiple concussions. Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Paul Eklund, Dr. Michael Cernota, and Bob McEwen for being part of the guests this evening on Beyond the Cheers to discuss concussions in hockey. In light of our conversations on this show, sports organizations need to take leadership, grab the helmet by the straps, and ensure the safety for those that play the game of hockey. We can no longer tolerate injuries to the head, whether it a result of direct or indirect blows, or even by fighting. The media can play an active role in this in not condoning fighting in the sport. If you can recall the statistics that involved 17 players, 24% of the concussion incidents were from fighting. Again, that was just 17 players. Fighting at the ultimate level, being the NHL, increases with every season. HockeyFights.com tracks NHL fisticuffs and had fights early this season running at an alarming rate of 0.78 per game. Now, if you project this out over the season, that means a fight in nearly half of the games, amounting to 540 fights over the 1,230 regular season matches. We don't need a new poster boy to replace Reggie Fleming. We want a game that we can be more proud of and diminish the number of life-altering injuries. Our kids need to live a normal, and as normal as their lives could have been, without concussion incidents that changed the path their life would have taken. We need to do a better job of educating players, coaches, parents, and everyone concerned with sport. Reportedly, only half of 156 minor hockey coaches passed a 2007 test recognizing concussion-like symptoms. Hockey organizations and all other sports, leagues, and associations, I throw down the proverbial hockey glove to challenge those to clean up the game for the sake of all those lives we cannot afford to alter in any way. Thanks again to my guests, Dr. Paul Eklund, Dr. Michael Cernota, and Bob McEwen, and to you, the avid listeners of the Beyond the Cheers family, for sending your emails, your phone calls, questions, and support for this program. I'm Dave Ferguson, wishing you a great day. It's certainly been a pleasure to have you part of the show today. Join our world at beyondthecheers.com. Until we chat again, live with a smile, share your laughter, and remember, it's all about attitude as we move beyond the cheers. I'm your host, Dave Ferguson. Have yourself a great day.